What does it take to be called a genius? If you've given that any thought at all, you've probably come up with some pretty abstract answers and qualifications. But in his new book called The Hidden Habits of Genius, Dr. Craig Wright has come up with some fairly concrete criteria for the genius tag. Craig Wright is Professor Emeritus of Music at Yale University. I asked him why he took on the search for genius.
I guess I took it on because I'm no genius. And I tell my children I've written this book on genius, and they think that's the funniest darn thing that they've ever heard. You're writing a book on genius? You're no genius. You're a plotter, and they're right. But I've spent a lot of time around geniuses. I went to Eastman School of Music trying to be a concert pianist, and I went to Harvard, and then I taught at Yale for 44 years. So I spent a lot of time around smart people, and I sort of watched what they were doing. It interested me. I was curious about it. I started reading about Mozart, started reading about Leonardo da Vinci, started reading about Einstein. My wife and I have 4 children and now 7 grandchildren, so I started watching them also. How does this all happen? How do we explain the mystery of exceptional human accomplishment? And that's what I got interested in, and that's what I'm still interested in.
Do you think as a music professor you can spot genius?
I think you can spot talent. I think you can spot successful playing. But I think the only way that you can spot true genius is if an individual changes what is being done in the field of music or what is being done in any particular art. So that causes me to say, well, what's a genius? A genius is an individual that changes the world, has an original idea for physics or original painting, original symphonic composition. Most of the people that we hear in music are simply performers, and they are, in a sense, like carpenters executing the instructions of the great architect. And I'm fond of saying that. I've actually met him, talked with him, an extraordinary person, Yo-Yo Ma, but he'd be the first to agree that he's no genius. The genius there is Mozart or Beethoven. So that's the way I would frame the issue with regard to music and geniuses. We've got to separate out the creator from the performer.
Do you think we throw around the word genius a bit too much these days?
Yeah, usually so. If you start Googling on the internet, genius, you get a gazillion hits. How many books are out there? We could go on and do an internet search on just how many books at Amazon, for example, have genius in the title. It's because it sells. Everybody's interested in the topic, but nobody ever really defines what genius is, and nobody really differentiates between, say, a celebrity and a performer as opposed to a transformative mind, somebody that changes the world. So the term is thrown out around all about, even in the highest circles. One person standing in a large White House recently said, actually twice on national television, I am a very stable genius. Okay, but that's yet another use of the word genius. It seems to be maybe, as you were suggesting, Bob, very much too much in the popular parlance. We got to think more carefully about it.
Can genius be learned or taught, for that matter?
I think you can load the dice in a particular way, particularly if you have a young person in your midst. And I would suggest doing things rather differently than you might suspect, I would think, and rather differently than I would have done with my own children, say, 30 years ago, having the experience now of thinking about genius, teaching this genius course at Yale for 15 years. And can you teach it? I think you can set up things. You can do certain things that will head the person in that direction. What I've learned is, although we might not be able to, each of us, to turn ourselves into geniuses, there are things that we can learn from watching geniuses that will allow us to change our own lives in very significant ways and make our own personal decisions and behave towards other people in ways that are diametrically opposed to what I would have done and what I was thinking, say, 15 years ago.
In your research, have you seen that genius can be mistaken for mental illness or vice versa?
That's a fascinating chapter, and it's an issue that still fascinates me. The chapter I'm referencing there that you've rightly brought up is Chapter 7. It's called Leverage Your Difference. And what I argue there, first of all, I go back through geniuses over history. We could start with people like Isaac Newton. We could come down through people like Beethoven. We could come down through Van Gogh, Virginia Woolf, Sylvia Plath, and so on. And the question is it a disability? For example, Isaac Newton, arguably, most scientists would still, before Einstein, would place Isaac Newton, the statue of Isaac Newton, ahead of that of Einstein, the greatest scientist who ever lived. He may have been on the autism spectrum. So the dilemma here is the following. Let's take Beethoven. Beethoven's music sounds a particular kind of way. In one composition, he bangs on the same note for 57 straight times, the beginning of even the famous symphony, da-da-da-da. It's like somebody pounding on you. Why? And I could go on and on about this, but the point is that I think Beethoven's music, and others have said this before me, Beethoven's music sounds differently because of his deafness. Van Gogh. He paints with unusual colors. He paints with striated strokes and pairs of colors. Is this because of the particular way he sees? What about Virginia Woolf? She had severe bipolar disorder, and she did many things. When in an institution, you read the book, Mrs. Dalloway, she shows up there doing the thing her Septimus Smith in that book is doing, all the things that Virginia herself did in the asylum. So the question is, what happens if we could change these people? The NIH is working on a cure for autism. That's that sort of stuff. We can have an operation now that would ameliorate various very kind of deafness that Beethoven had. But do we want to do that? Because then I don't get any more novels by Virginia Woolf. I don't get any great symphonies from Beethoven. Maybe I don't get any more Starry Nights on the coffee mug that I'm holding up here by Van Gogh. So it's kind of, what are we going to do? You make the choice, general populace. It's a real moral dilemma.
You have a chapter in the book about relaxation being one of the things that genius needs, and you tell a great story about how Paul McCartney came up with the song Yesterday. I wonder if you'd tell us that.
Well, so many of the people, as I mentioned there in the chapter, and I think about a dozen mentioned there, say that they fell asleep at a particular point in their life and a creation came to them. Now, why is that the case? I fall asleep, but I don't have symphonies popping into my head because I don't really have music coursing in and out. But sometimes I get ideas about a book like this coursing in and out. So you got to be obsessed with what you're doing sort of 24/7, day and night. And if you're in that state of mind, there are other things that begin to go on. Neurologists, neurobiologists, those that study sleep disorders have pointed out that there's this neurotransmitter called acetylcholine that courses through your brain, particularly during rapid eye movement sleep at the end of your sleep pattern early in the morning. So it turns out the best thing you can do is go get a lot of stuff in your head, go to sleep, have a good night's sleep, and then when you wake up in the morning, don't get out of bed to be productive. Sit there, just relax, let acetylcholine work its magic, and think of all the problems you're going to have to deal with during the day, because that's probably when you're actually most productive. But there's one key to this, and this is what Einstein did. He always had pen and paper next to his nightstand, or on his nightstand, so that when he had these ideas coming to him, he could write them down. McCartney did the same thing. Remember, you asked the question about Paul McCartney and the song Yesterday. It's in his head. He goes over to the piano, plays around with it, takes it into the studio, talks to John Lennon about it. They can figure out where he came from. So eventually he copyrights it and it becomes one of the most famous pop songs of the 20th century. Well, that's the way this happens. And sometimes it's happened because we are relaxed.
So can a genius just, tumble out of bed in the morning and be brilliant, or do they need to get into some sort of routine?
Routine, Bob, is very important. All of the people that I've studied have a routine for work. Why do they have a routine? It's not the same routine. I've had the pleasure of, say, visiting Ernest Hemingway's house in Key West, Florida, and he's got this little separate bungalow out there, and he would go out and write on top of uses, standing up on this, leaning next to his bookcase, typing with his Underwood typewriter. Each of them have particular sorts of habits. Thomas Wolfe used to write on top of a refrigerator because he was very tall, but they all write the same place at the same time every day, or they go to the piano, or they go to their studio. why did they, I guess the question is, why do they do this? It saves time. It's a very efficient way of operating. They limit their choices, and they are able to focus on their work by limiting their choices. So after we relax, then it comes time to focus. So one of the things we've got to do, we've got to get into that work zone, whether it's the lab, whether it's the artist studio, whether it's the study, to do the work. And once you're there, in a sense, there's no retreat. Tell your spouse or significant other you're going up to work until noon and you come back in 10 minutes. It looks like you're a real quitter. So once they're there, they almost have no choice. And then they can, if they've got enough stuff in their head and they've had some insights the previous night, then they can start to bang it out to get the product out the door.
Well, in the end, has this project changed the way you look at genius or look for genius?
It certainly has. It certainly has changed the way I look at particularly my grandchildren and now in the way I talk to them now. First of all, IQ scores are hugely overrated. And I would say to them, and I would say to the parents today, if I say to my children regarding their children, don't worry about their grades. They're horrified. Don't worry about getting into that Ivy League school. They're horrified. So what I've learned is you don't have to, IQ is only one part of the story here, and there are many other ways in which you can excel. The most important thing that you can tell a youngster, I think, is to not to focus on one particular issue or one particular strength, but to diversify the experience as much as possible. Give them the opportunity to fail. Get them out there and don't pick them up when they fall. Don't get them out of the scrapes when they get into scrapes. And Lord knows my children got into scrapes and had gotten out of a lot of scrapes. And maybe we shouldn't have done that. Maybe we should have let them learn more. It's hard as parents. Your natural instinct is to support the child, but maybe the child learns more through failure and getting up themselves. So take lots of disparate courses in schools. Don't worry so much about the grades, but the disparity of the courses, because you'll learn a lot of different things. And ultimately, I suppose, cross-train and learn to deal with failure, because that is the kind of thing that's going to carry you a long way in the long haul.
I bet your kids you didn't talk to your kids like that when it was their grades you were talking about.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I don't know. I'll tell you what, what this brings up is the difference between success and genius. My children are all, I'm proud to say, very successful. They're very successful in different sorts of ways. None of them is a genius. At least that's not manifested yet. Maybe they will be. It takes a long time for this to happen. So we have to differentiate between success and genius. But so maybe that what I've been articulating with my children is the path towards success. What I've been articulating with my grandchildren is the path toward genius.
Again, the name of Dr. Craig Wright's new book is The Hidden Habits of Genius, Beyond Talent, IQ, and Grit, Unlocking the Secrets of Greatness. Still to come, it doesn't take a genius to know that you don't microwave fish at the office. Or does it? We'll talk about that next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. After years of college life, most students know their way around a campus and how to navigate the everyday customs and subtle messages of that life. So how does that translate into the business world? For a lot of graduates, not so good. That's where Peter Yawitz comes in. He has a website, a blog, and a new podcast called Advice from Someone Else's Dad, where he tries to help young professionals manage the transition to life in the working world. Some of that advice is in a book called Flip-Flops and Microwaved Fish, Navigating the Do's and Don'ts of Workplace Culture. Yawitz is the founder of Clear Communications and coaches executives and other professionals on how to identify and communicate messages clearly to critical audiences. We spoke about someone else's dad.
Well, I've been a management communication consultant for about 30 years, and one of my favorite gigs over that time is to run effective communication seminars for new young global hires, most of whom are right out of college. And during the seminars, I usually open it up for questions, and over time I found that these young people are eager to know how to handle themselves in all sorts of situations that they're anticipating. So I developed this persona of what I call someone else's dad, which eventually became a website with lots of advice, some fun and informative video scenarios, and also a Dear Dad column where people can ask me questions. The feedback that I've gotten has been from the young people, where the target audience, but also from people maybe not as old as us, Bob, but certainly middle ground, where people have always said, gosh, if I had only had this when I started my job. Because I think of the mistakes that I've made or that we've all made over time. So my job here is to give people just a straightforward and hopefully amusing way of looking at the workplace and know what to do and what not to do.
A lot of the things you talk about are, you know, common sense business ideas, but there are some things that people should have learned in school, like you have a whole thing on writing skills.
Yeah, you know, I have always been one of these people who loved grammar, which is probably why I didn't have a lot of friends. But I hold that really dear to my core of who I am. You know, the three rules I abide by are the laws of the land, the golden rule, be nice to other people, and make sure you have good grammar. And it bothers me, and I know there are other people like me out there, when they'll read an email and see that something, that there's misuse of words or bad punctuation, and I maybe being a little bit oversensitive to it, will judge people a little bit that way. So my view is, here's some basic ideas on how to write. The thing about the English language is that there are lots of ways to say the same thing, and maybe the simplest way is best. Don't try to overcomplicate things. A sentence is just basically a noun and a verb and some other stuff. So keep it simple and just try to impart information.
You have pages of cliches and what you really should be saying there. You have one that is my one of my favorite pet peeves is, it is what it is. You want to throw something at someone when they say that.
Yeah, it's just one of these things that's come up in the past couple of years, I think, right? Well, that's how do you end a conversation? Well, you know, that's the way the ball bounces. It is what it is. And then you just kind of stop the conversation there with, yeah, I guess you're right. You can't deny that things are not the way they are. But people use it as a most profound statement. So I'm not necessarily anti-cliché, but I wonder why people say it. And really, people say these phrases because other people say it and they want to fit in well. Some of my least favorite ones are, go after the low-hanging fruit. Just because, everybody says that. And the funny thing about going after low-hanging fruit, I was once talking to someone who grew up on a farm who said, you know, honestly, you don't want to go after the low-hanging fruit because that's all the crummy stuff the animals chew on.
Exactly, yes. Has there always been this kind of communications gap between the generations?
I think there has been. I mean, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I think you are too, right, Bob?
Absolutely.
And when we started at work, there were people who probably looked at us and said, look at those money-grubbing go-getters. And, you know, you said, no, that's not me, though. My friends are that way, but not me. So I think there's always been a difference in generations, and I think that, and there always will be. So what my recommendation to managers is, you have to adapt. A lot of people today say, well, millennials are all, and then fill in the blank. And just the way we said, well, that's just not me, I say the same thing about millennials. They're not all the same. Some people might be more of something than others, but I think it's really up to us workers together to adapt. And one way, the big change now is that, and again, I can't speak for all millennials, but things have changed in terms of social media. And people can see and broadcast what they do and what they like and how they live. And there's a little bit among some people of this fear of missing out and, oh, wow, you have such a great life. I wonder if I could have that kind of life at work. And I think that just can lead to disappointment. And I'm not saying social media is horrible, but I think we have to realize together that if this is out there, all right, understand where people are coming from.
Do you spend more time teaching workers to communicate with managers or the other way around?
Well, it's a combination. A lot of it is, I'd say the questions that I get are really in three areas. One would be on personal growth, let's say how to ask for a raise, how do I get a promotion, how do I get a mentor, to personal workplace issues, which would be, I worry that I don't fit in, I hate company events, do I have to talk to my manager who's in the next toilet stall? And, well, actually, that's in the third one. There's a personal workplace issue is more like small, how do I deal with small talk? And then the third one is dealing with others, like I have a nasty boss or a smelly coworker, or again, that famous one about talking to a manager in an adjacent toilet stall. So I would say things are really in those three categories.
I don't know if this affects the way you do your work at all, but we now have elected a businessman to office who doesn't follow any of these rules. Does that make your job more difficult?
Well, without getting into political stuff, I will say that one thing that I find is missing in the world is a level of grace. And I do mention that in my book. You know, we all are trying to get along at work. We should share a common goal. And if people aren't playing by the rules, that honestly, that's just not fair. And I think, I don't know whether it comes directly from the top of how the country is run, but it certainly, let's just say it bothers me that there's lack of grace. And that lack of grace has become cultural in some sectors.
That was very good. One of your small talk rules was avoid politics. That's nice.
Yes.
Following your own
rules.
Well,
this is NPR, so I know a little bit about my audience.
Well, actually, know your audience is one of your basic rules, too, isn't it?
I think that is. When people say to me, in a nutshell, what is the most important thing I should know about communication, it really is know your audience. And whether you think about it, you're doing it every day. I'm talking to you, and your audience might be different from how I would say something to my own children or to a client or to a man on the street or the garbage man. We adapt our messages all the time with the amount of detail and the level of language that we use. So we're doing it naturally, and I think it's important for people to use that skill to think about what you want at work, how you have to talk to anybody, writing or speaking, and to speak at the right level. And another thing that people forget about is timing, which is a part of understanding an audience. How much time now do people have to spend listening to you or reading what you've written? And that's something that a lot of young people really haven't mastered because they are coming from college where they have to write a long paper where they get extra credit for extra work, or they're texting each other with very quick messages. So they have to learn how to balance what is right in the workplace. So yeah, understanding your audience really is the most important thing that you can master as a communicator.
You have stood in front of classrooms before. If you were putting together a course, could you put together a college course to teach people these skills to go out into the world?
I could, and I have stayed away from that just because I don't want to be a college professor doing a semester-long class, but I know people who do. I would say that the only problem teaching a full semester class to college students is that it becomes too theoretical. The most successful communication courses are ones that are taught maybe in executive MBA programs because people are working and also communicating at the same time. So it's really important to have a context for communication. So as much as I think it's great to take a course in undergrad in communication, if it's not real and too theoretical, it's a little bit harder for people to grasp.
You can find Peter Yawitz's blog and podcast at someoneelsesdad.com. The name of his book is Flip Flops and Microwaved Fish, Navigating the Do's and Don'ts of Workplace Culture. Teachers' lives have been turned upside down during the pandemic, and there doesn't seem to be a quick road back to normal. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Teachers face an uncertain future in the face of COVID-19. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Jean Carey Engel, associate professor in the Department of Elementary and Early Childhood Education at Bridgewater State University, details some challenges and strategies educators have used to keep everyone's heads above water.
As the United States educational system abruptly moved to remote instruction in the spring of 2020, teachers were told to prepare to teach their students online. My research partners and I realized that this moment in the history of education had to be captured. So we began with a simple premise: ask teachers about their experience during this wild and unprecedented change. Over 700 pre-K through 12 teachers responded to our survey. Their responses have been generous and at times both hopeful and sad. The biggest challenges faced by our teachers? Number one, technology. Kids don't have it, it's not dependable, and everyone's trying to learn it. Number two, meeting the needs of all learners. Kids with special education needs, kids who speak English as a second language, kids who are homeless and living in shelters, kids who have to work or care for younger siblings. And number three, the challenge of well-being. Teachers worry about their students, especially the ones they haven't heard from, and they worry about themselves and their families. As one of our high school teachers said, "I was never prepared for this." And given that COVID-19 is far from over, we were particularly interested in how teachers are problem-solving. Here are a few of their strategies. First, connections. We can't overstate the importance of teacher-to-teacher connections, online communities, and working with parents. Next, digital literacy. From learning to Zoom to learning to TikTok, teachers have had to teach themselves technology at a rapid pace. And finally, in the words of a pre-K teacher, breaking the rules. Teachers told us over and over they had to be creative, flexible, and patient with their students, their parents, and themselves.
That was Jean Carey Engel of Bridgewater State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TVOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.